unequal pay today on the world. I'm Marco Werman. A top BBC journalist, China editor Carrie Gracie, quits her job in protest. She was making a lot less than other international editors who happened to be men.
I could not go back to China and collude knowingly in what I consider to be unlawful pay discrimination. I can't do it.
We'll have a reaction from Britain and hear about this simple fix being tried in Iceland.
So what you do is you evaluate the job and then you pay based on the merits of the job, not who is doing the work.
Plus, a band from L.A. that combines heavy metal with mariachi.
This is something new that we're giving to the world, and we're very proud of it.
All coming up, where else but right here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and it's The World. It is great to be starting the week with you. It was quite impressive to see the determination of women at the Golden Globe Awards last night, calling out sexism and discrimination on a high-profile stage. But we begin today on the show with a reminder that a lot of work still needs to be done when it comes to ensuring parity between men and women in general, but also right here in our industry.
I've been in the BBC for more than 30 years. This is my professional family. I want it to be the best. Every day I go out without fear or favour, facing intimidation in China, facing censorship, and actually telling the story and shining a light. I'm not going to not shine a light when I find a problem in my home organisation that needs saying.
That's Carrie Gracie, the China editor at our partners at BBC. We've had her on the show before, and don't forget that this show, The World, is a BBC co-production, so this story really hits home with my colleagues here in the newsroom. This weekend, Carrie Gracie quit her job in protest over the fact that men with the same title as hers at the BBC were making at least 50% more. What you just heard was from an interview Carrie gave this morning to the BBC. Here's a bit more.
I could not go back to China and collude knowingly in what I consider to be unlawful pay discrimination. I could not do it, nor could I stay silent and watch the BBC perpetuate a failing pay structure by discriminating against women. I can't do it.
Many women who work for the BBC have voiced similar complaints about unequal pay, and an audit last year revealed that, on average, men at the BBC are paid 9% more than their female colleagues. Britain does have an Equal Pay Act. It was passed in 2010. Anne Perkins is with the Guardian newspaper in the UK. Anne, how surprised were you to hear of Carrie's resignation?
It was an incredibly brave and bold thing to do. So from that point of view, I was surprised. I mean, she is a woman of a journalist of incredibly high repute, very, very well regarded. For her to stand down was astonishing. On the other hand, am I surprised to learn more evidence of the fact that the BBC, in common with many, many other employers, does not pay men and women fairly and equally? No, not at all.
So you heard Carrie say the words unlawful pay discrimination. What legal protection does the UK actually offer to people in this situation?
Well, it's an incredibly fraught field, which, of course, is why it's so hard and so persistent. You know, we've been fighting this campaign for 200 years or more, and the Equal Pay Act went on the statute books 50 years ago. But it is so hard to bring a successful case because there is always a defence. Essentially, you should be paid the same amount of money for the same value work. And that's the problem, because the employer can always argue that there is some difference in the nature of the work or in what the employee brings to it that justifies a pay differential. And it's an extraordinarily difficult thing to resolve. I mean, you know, we make progress very slowly. Carrie's argument was not only that the BBC was not paying fairly and that she thought she had a legal case. I mean, you know, it's interesting that there is uncertainty even over such an apparently open and shut case as hers, but that the BBC was so opaque and secretive, and she hinted downright disingenuous about what it pays to whom, that it becomes very hard for groups of women to get together and campaign, very difficult to understand the extent of the problem, and very difficult, therefore, to bring action to end it.
Before we go on, I'm just struck when you said that we have been fighting this for this pay inequality for 200 years. This started before 20th century feminism?
It did start before 20th century feminism, and it was a very early ambition of the Trades Union Congress, which is celebrating its 150th birthday today. But the reformers of the 1830s thought that simply in terms of natural justice, people should be paid the same amount for the same kind of work. And that's been the campaign. I won't give you the complete lecture, but it is a very, very long and hard-fought campaign.
How much do we see this across the UK, across other industries in the UK?
But I mean, it is very widespread. We can see that in national statistics. We can see the distinction from the lowest paid cohorts of workers, and particularly those, mainly women, who work part-time, where the differential is still just short of 20%. And you can see it also at the very top end, where some men are paid, considerable numbers of men, are paid as much as half of as much again as the women. And the attitude towards it is clear in a new government requirement that companies file returns showing how the gender pay gap is reflected in their workforce. And only 6% of all the companies obliged to fill in this return, which must be done by the beginning of April, have so far done it. Human resources people and management generally are just refusing to engage with this process.
So we're about to hear from Iceland, where laws make things a little different. But I'm just wondering about anger in the UK, because in the US, anger over equal pay has been growing for years. Where does the debate stand in Britain right now?
Well, I think this becomes part, as was clear at the Golden Globes last night, actually, this is all becoming part of women's determination to stand together, to see off all forms of discrimination, whether it is in pay or whether it is in the system which operates universally, where women are obliged to put up with sexual abuse and sometimes worse. And the men are, even in cases where it's where a charge is upheld, are never penalised or rarely penalised at all.
I'm just curious, what do you make of the denial by the BBC of systemic discrimination within their ranks?
They're conflating two things. There's equal pay, which relates very particularly to the pay usually between one person and another person, or perhaps between one small group of workers doing the same kind of work or work of the same value as another group, and the gender pay gap, which addresses distinctions of pay, differences of pay in a much wider cohort of workers. And, you know, the BBC has probably a better than average position on the gender pay gap, which is what it's hiding behind. But we can see that it's as reluctant as everyone else to address serious issues of equal pay.
That's Anne Perkins. She's a columnist for The Guardian in London. Iceland also has an equal pay law, and it got an update a few days ago. New rules require all companies with at least 25 employees to obtain government certification of their equal pay policies. Those companies that fail to receive the certification will be fined and publicly outed. The hope is that it'll eliminate the pay gap in Iceland, which was at 16% as of last year. Dæni Arðardóttir Pind is a board member of the Icelandic Women's Rights Association. How is this law being received in Iceland?
It was kind of like mixed. A lot of people think this is a good step, myself included, but we had some critical voices as well.
Yeah, what were they saying?
Yeah, like some people think it's complicated, it's costly, because it is kind of bureaucratic. You have to get a certification and you have to evaluate every job. But I mean, you can say as well, I mean, if you have a environmental management system or like a quality standard to something that you're doing, everything is, all rules and regulations are costly in a way, I think. Mm. That was the main criticism, just that this would cost too much. Not the fact that the pay had to be like leveled up for women, just the bureaucracy would be costly.
I mean, Iceland is a really interesting country to talk about when we're looking at pay gaps, because according to the World Economic Forum, Iceland has the best track record on gender equality in the world. But you Icelanders still have a pay gap. Why do you think that gap is so difficult to eliminate?
Yeah, I mean, this is the million-dollar question, really. There's no country that has equal pay, at least I don't know of any, and I think there is none. But you can see when you look into like sectors or even companies that are trying to take steps to eliminate the pay gap, and they are really using methods that are really similar to this new legislation. So what you do is you evaluate the job and then you pay based on the merits of the job, not who is doing the work. So it really puts some work on employers, but the result should be that the system of managing pay should be set up in a way that's understandable and it's fair.
From your perspective, I mean, you grew up in Iceland, but what is this news from the UK of the BBC journalist Kerry Gracie resigning in protest of pay discrimination? What does that mean to you, that story?
I mean, I totally understand her. What I don't understand is why the BBC hasn't handled this differently, because there you have it, like black and white, that the people are doing the same work, but women are getting paid like half or something.
What do you think the BBC should have done?
I feel like they're kind of overcomplicating it. Like, why can't they just pay people the same? They're doing the same work. I would probably be a little bit offended if the Icelandic national TV station, if something about like this came out about how they are paying their people.
Presumably that new law in Iceland is going to prevent things like that.
Yeah, that's the thing. We have pay differences. We know that. The numbers show that. But it's so hard to find them. But if you go through this, so it's like preventative measures, really. So if something like this would have been in place at the BBC before this had happened, it probably wouldn't have happened. If the standard is going to work as we hope it will.
Dani, I'm just curious, how did women's rights become kind of like your mission?
I don't know. I mean, probably just inspiration from all these previous generations of women.
In Iceland. So,
yeah. And I also feel like I always felt like we were almost there. Like we're going in the right direction. The pay gap is going down. Violence is going down, blah, blah, blah. But like it never happens. We're like always having the same discussion over and over and over again. And I mean, I've been part of this for what, 10, 15 years or something. And we are still discussing the same things.
When you say we were almost there, what stopped you from kind of going further?
I don't think we were almost there. I just, it was just like, I was describing this feeling that you have, like when you're kind of young and you're maybe taking part in a protest and
that idealism.
Or a demonstration or something. Yeah, kind of, yeah. But I actually feel like this could actually have an impact.
Dani Aradóttir-Pind, a board member of the Icelandic Women's Rights Association. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
A quick note now on a story we're working on for tomorrow's show. The CIA says Kim Jong-un does not intend to give up his nuclear weapons. Tomorrow, we'll meet a former U.S. negotiator who says North Korea's next move is anybody's guess.
They've shot down aircraft, seized American ships. We don't know what exactly they're going to attempt to do with their newfound nuclear power.
What North Korea wants and why, that's on the show tomorrow. Just ahead on the show, how fire and fury is going down in Europe. You're with the world. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with the world. Okay, how many fire and fury conversations did you have this weekend? You know, the book, Michael Wolff's bombshell look inside the Trump White House. It's got a lot of people talking. Critics say it's gossipy and that many of the anecdotes in it are either not new or uncorroborated. But Trump detractors and some people who cover the White House say it rings true. And in the UK, at least, the book seems to be getting just as much attention as here. Oliver Bullough is a journalist and author in London. Who's talking about Fire and Fury in London today, Oliver?
Well, I think just about everyone, really. My four-year-old isn't talking about it, but at the school gate this morning, everyone was talking about it.
Really?
And my mother-in-law, who's just come to pick up the kids, she's talking about it. So, no, I think it's pretty much one of the big topics of conversation. I think everyone recognizes that it's gossipy, that maybe not everything in it is the gospel truth. But still, it's pretty hard to imagine a book like this being written about a politician a year ago even. So I suppose it suggests quite how far we've come.
Yeah. So what are people saying about what they're reading in this book? What have you heard?
Well, I mean, I'd like to say, I mean, I've only read the excerpts, so I haven't read the whole book, but just from the excerpts I've read, and I think everyone just shares a sort of kind of appalled fascination. The level of haplessness is so extraordinary. I think the main emotion is just sort of a degree of bafflement and horror, really, that this is what's happening to, you know, our closest partner as a country, really, or one of our closest partners.
I mean, the way you talk about it, Oliver, it sounds almost like Brits are not paying attention to their own prime minister, focus more on the States. Am I right?
Well, everyone knows when there's two TV channels on, you watch the one which is most interesting, right? I mean, Britain and America have this news relationship because it's all in English, so we can just click over and read the New York Times if there isn't anything interesting in the Times. The London Times, yeah. Sorry. So, yeah, I mean, today, for example, there is a government reshuffle happening here. I haven't really been following it very closely because it's sort of one guy I haven't really heard of, you know, being moved to a job I don't really understand. Whereas, you know, if I follow the US politics at the moment, everything is bigger, brighter, more extraordinary, more bizarre. So no, I can't speak for everyone in the country, but certainly most people I'm friends with are a lot more interested in what's happening in Washington at the moment than what's happening in Westminster.
And are people still on the fence in the UK about Trump? Like, is Michael Wolff's book changing any minds about the Trump presidency?
Well, I think a lot of the stuff that was in there has been widely, if not reported in precisely those kind of appalling detail, has been widely trailed in other ways. I think what has been noticeable is that at the beginning of the Trump presidency, possibly there was a feeling among people who voted leave in the Brexit referendum that Trump would be an ally, you know, someone who could help Britain through this difficult period. I think that feeling has now largely gone, except among possibly a few diehards. I think that there's a realization that because of, you know, Trump being president, Britain is much more on its own than maybe many people hoped that it would be. You know, obviously, he is no friend of the World Trade Organization, which is going to be very important to us in the years ahead because of leaving the European Union. He doesn't appear to be much of a friend of NATO, which again is a problem for the UK. NATO is very much, you know, quite important to our defense strategy. So, you know, it is, I think that there is, even people who were a year ago felt that maybe he was on their side politically are beginning to think that actually it's a lot more complicated than that. So, yes, I think a lot of people who were giving him the benefit of the doubt or actually were welcoming him as president are now increasingly concerned about what he means.
I know this is a broad question, Oliver, but how would you characterize British and European opinions of Donald Trump as president?
Well, I would say it's overwhelmingly negative. You know, I think that the way that in foreign affairs he has been much more friendly to leaders like the royal family of Saudi Arabia, to the president of Turkey, obviously to President Putin of Russia, which is a particular interest of mine as a Russianist, has been marked. You know, his relationship to Britain, he has, during a major terrorist incident in London, he decided to tweet an insult against the mayor of London. He tweeted out propaganda of a worryingly influential British neo-Nazi group, Britain First.
Right.
You know, these things did not pass unnoticed in this country. And there have been equivalent problems with France, with Germany, and with other European countries. So I think in general, opinion is negative. He is still supposedly planning to visit the UK. I think when he does, it is likely that there will be very large protests against him.
Author and journalist Oliver Bullough in London, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you for having me.
On New Year's Day, California joined 7 other states in legalizing recreational pot. 29 states currently allow medical marijuana use. But remember this, in all of these states, undocumented immigrants caught with pot can be deported. That's because marijuana is still illegal federally and federal law controls immigration. U.S. Attorney General Jeff Sessions waded into these murky legal waters last week. He reversed the Cole memo, an Obama-era policy that paved the way for states to legalize pot. Sessions is now instructing federal prosecutors to go after people who sell and use marijuana. With me is Brendan Woods, the public defender in Oakland, California. He says immigrants need to be careful.
So particularly with immigrants, it's really unfortunate because anyone who is convicted of possession over 30 grams of marijuana, whether they're legally or not, they will otherwise not be admitted to the United States. They'll be deportable. So if you think about that, that is a relatively small amount of marijuana, and it's just barely above what is now the legal limit.
So in the discussions about Sessions' latest move in the media, I've mainly seen reactions from the pot industry and from Congress. Do you think there's a voice missing from the discussion? Like, what are you hearing from undocumented people? Do they really feel like this decriminalization is going to protect them, or are they really worried?
I think they are worried and have to be worried just based on the current administration's stance towards immigration in general. This administration has made it clear that they are not friends to the immigrant community, and they're going to enforce everything, and they're going to try to remove people for almost any petty violation.
I mean, Attorney General Sessions has a hard line, as you said, on immigration. He also has a hard line on pot. And I'm just wondering if you see this latest move as the Attorney General's way of breaking sanctuary in California, it's a sanctuary state, as a way, another way to go after immigrants.
It'll be interesting to see how this, how Sessions' interpretation is really enforced here in California with the rescinding of the Cole memo. You know, we will see. I doubt that there'll be any strict enforcement with regards to that in California, just because of manpower, and it would be hugely unpopular with the prosecutors that are on the ground, the agencies that are on the ground. You know, they're all resource strapped. And when the voters have spoken and made it legal to now go after them, does not seem like the best use of resources at all.
And how independent do you think the prosecutors are?
That's a great question. I think the prosecutors in California are more liberal. They do have to cooperate with local law enforcement here and the local prosecutors here. And there is the voice of the voters who've spoken. And so we'll see how it plays out. I can't imagine, and I could be wrong, but I can't imagine there would be a huge uptick in enforcement here in California.
Brendan Woods, the public defender of Alameda County in Oakland, California. Thanks very much.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
I'm Marco Werman. As Congress rushes to avoid a government shutdown, a key immigration issue is taking a back seat on Capitol Hill. This activist wants to remind members of Congress that
this is a vote that puts you on the right side of history. Nobody ever said that being on the right side of history is easy.
That story is still ahead right here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. Young undocumented immigrants who are beneficiaries of the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals Program, or DACA as it's called, are paying close attention to legislation being debated in the nation's capital right now. This particular deal is also tied up in avoiding a government shutdown. That's what we're facing in less than 2 weeks unless Congress can pass a spending bill. The thing is, over the weekend, President Trump said that any deal on the Dreamers, as DACA recipients are called, would have to include plans for a border wall with Mexico. Sana Abrar is the policy and advocacy manager with the immigrant advocacy group United We Dream. Nearly every Democrat is against Trump's border wall, but why are they divided on how to vote for the spending bill now?
We've seen progressive champions like Senator Warren, Senator Harris, Congressman Gutierrez, Senators Durbin, Booker, and Sanders. They were ultimately the first to come out and make it completely clear that any kind of must-pass bill, including any kind of spending bill that didn't include the DREAM Act, essentially ignored the fact that there is a humanitarian crisis at hand that hundreds of thousands of immigrant youth are currently facing. Obviously, when it comes to the DREAM Act, in an ideal world, we and many of our supporters would love for a standalone DREAM Act to come to the floor and be passed. But the reality is we are facing a Republican-led House, Senate, and White House. So what we're hoping for January 19th is that we see a solid show of support from the Democratic caucus as a whole in getting this done.
So the activists who are pushing for the DREAM Act, I mean, what is the level of frustration right now, considering that it didn't get done at the end of 2017, and now it seems like some Democrats are on the fence about holding out for an immigration bill that's tied to a spending bill?
I mean, it's a huge disappointment. When it came to December, we had activists who were lobbying on the Hill every single day. We had a tent and a jumbotron outside of Congress that, you know, shared the stories of individuals who are directly impacted by the lack of action by Congress. And now we're at this point where it's the beginning of 2018. We have thousands more who continue to lose their status. Disappointment is probably an understatement when it comes to our reaction. But also there's this new sense of, okay, this is the make or break moment. We can't keep pushing this off. We have to show this administration that these demands are unacceptable.
Are you going after specific lawmakers for their votes?
We have been working to essentially call out Republicans who have not been vocal about this issue, despite the incredibly large immigrant populations in their communities, to call out the individuals who voted for the continuing resolution in December. Our goal is that all members of the Democratic caucus are aligned with us when it comes to January 19th, that they make it clear that they will vote for any kind of continuing resolution or must-pass spending bill only if it includes the DREAM Act. Obviously, with the spending bill, when it comes to the numbers game, Republicans need Democratic support in the Senate to actually pass any kind of spending bill. So the trick here is to show that there is a complete show of support for the DREAM Act.
And yet that unanimous show of support is not happening. And it puzzles me because the openness of American society to welcome immigrants has been one of the things Democrats have been offering as what makes them different from many Republicans, certainly what differentiates them from Trump. Are you surprised by these Democrats on the fence?
To be honest, no. There have been plenty who have expressed to us, the ones from more moderate states, who are taking into account 2018 and elections, that this is a tough vote. But the way that we respond to this is, look, we understand it's a tough vote. It's a tough position to take for some of you. But the position that our membership is in is more than the word tough, right? These are individuals who are losing the opportunities to continue pursuing their higher education, who are at immediate risk of being fired by their employers. This is more than just tough, right? This is a life and death kind of moment. We are trying to get politicians to understand that this isn't just a political talking point or some kind of game, that people are currently living in limbo. They don't know what's going to happen. There is no time to delay. This is a vote that puts you on the right side of history. Nobody ever said that being on the right side of history is easy.
Sana Abrar, Policy and Advocacy Manager with United We Dream. Thanks very much for your time.
Thank you. Appreciate the time.
Speaking of living in limbo, let's go back 8 years ago, the earthquake that devastated Haiti, in which it's still recovering from, 8 years ago this week. You'll remember that international aid flowed in by boat and air and overland across Haiti's only land border with the Dominican Republic. For a while, all that aid was crucial, but the thing is, it made Haiti even more dependent on foreign assistance and more vulnerable than ever to other countries dumping cheap goods on Haiti. The Haitian government has tried to stop this and to encourage their people to produce their own goods. But as Amy Bracken reports, Haiti's now got a real chicken and egg problem.
The sun is beginning to set over the Dominican town of Jimeni on the Haitian border, and two truckloads of eggs are being unloaded, carton by carton, and sold to Haitian buyers. But instead of carrying the eggs back across the border, the buyers put them into wheelbarrows and run them over to an enormous lake. They then load them into wooden boats, which will glide ashore somewhere in Haiti under the cover of night. In 2008, Haiti effectively banned the import of Dominican eggs, citing health concerns. Enforcement lapsed after the earthquake, but the next year, Haiti clamped down again. Officials tout the ban as a way to support domestic egg production and create jobs. And yet, the flow across the border continues. For many egg sellers and importers, the ban is a headache, but not a deterrent. Luc Nere Exilus is Haitian, but he's one of the people selling eggs for a Dominican company. And he says the customs agents on the Haitian side of the border hurt his business.
The Haitian squads take what people have just bought from us and destroy it. There are weeks when we don't sell because people are afraid to buy.
But he makes money most of the time, and that's a lot better than never, which is what he says would happen if he stayed in Haiti with his wife and daughter. Once the eggs reach the shore in Haiti, buyers pick them up for resale in Port-au-Prince. But en route, they could be confiscated. Jocelyn Lefebvre, who sells the eggs in a Port-au-Prince market, says it happens a lot.
Custom agents are always taking our stuff, they burn it, they throw it out, they're always chasing us.
It hardly seems worth it. It's a two-hour trip to the border, and Lefebvre has to pay for the eggs in U.S. dollars or Dominican pesos. Still, it's cheaper than buying Haitian eggs, which can cost anywhere from 10 to 100% more. So why can't Haiti produce the most basic things for itself, like a low-cost chicken egg? Michel Chancy is an agronomist who advises the Ministry of Agriculture. He says it's especially expensive in Haiti, in part because just about everything is imported. The birds, the cages, the feed. It's a product of what's plagued Haiti for several decades. Low growth, declining agriculture, and floundering industry. The reasons include political instability and too little government investment. Chancy says the government needs to motivate banks to give loans and make feed cheaper, and it has to control the border. In other words, be more like the Dominicans.
They banned the import of all poultry products so they could protect investments. Now, after 15 to 20 years, it's paid off. And when they have an egg surplus, they can dump it into the Haitian market.
Haiti has made some progress on egg production. And an official at the Agriculture Ministry says if the government decides to make the poultry industry a priority, Haiti could be egg independent in 15 to 25 years. And that could mean jobs in the long run. Chancy agrees that it requires a choice.
The state and Haitian society need to know what they want. Do they want to facilitate access to cheap products? Or do they want to create work for people to plant corn and millet and have a market for their products? That's the choice we have to make.
But Jorel Ibar wants both. On the sidewalk, he's selling breakfast plates, fried eggs with spaghetti and tomato sauce. It's not service with a smile. He says he's buying his ingredients as cheaply as he can, which means...
Everything is Dominican. This tomato sauce, Dominican. Eggs, Dominican. Spaghetti, Dominican.
For Ibar, it's a painful reality.
If they block the border, we'll all die in this country.
Before blocking the border, Ibar says, the government needs to create jobs. This all reflects a persistent question in a vicious cycle propelled by poverty. Which comes first? For The World, Amy Bracken, Port-au-Prince.
Amy's story was produced in collaboration with Round Earth Media. Michelle Joseph assisted with the reporting. In 2015, attackers struck the offices in Paris of Charlie Hebdo. That's the often outrageous French satire magazine featuring the work of cartoonists. 12 people were killed and about a dozen more were injured. After the attack, Charlie Hebdo's cartoonists seemed undeterred. They continued to speak and draw exactly what was on their minds. But today, the reality of their lives is way more challenging. And that's reflected in Charlie Hebdo's first issue of 2018. It's a look inward at the real cost of what it takes to run a magazine that still, many people believe, have extremist crosshairs on it.
They're bearing their soul in this issue. They are talking about the difficulty that they have in producing a newspaper every week in the conditions they have to deal with, you know, security conditions and also the fear.
That's reporter Adeline Sia speaking with us from France earlier today. I asked her to describe the cover of the new issue.
So you see from front to back a heavily bolted, armored kind of security door. And the headline of this cover is 3 years in a tin can. So that there's the idea that the cartoonists are trapped.
And based on what you've read about the writers and cartoonists at Charlie Hebdo over the last 3 years, do you think it has been a cloistered existence?
Well, everyone knew that they had a cloistered existence, but this is the first time that they're giving us in detail an account of what they're going through. They can never go out with their spouses or their children in public for fear, of course, of endangering their lives. Every time they have to go out of their homes, they have to make sure security is in place. I mean, you can imagine that for someone just trying to publish a paper, it seems absurd.
Yeah. So is every day now, 3 years later, for these writers and cartoonists, every day coming to the office just filled with fear?
That's what they seem to say. Charlie Hebdo continues to receive death threats. And certainly, you know, there are tight security measures in place. But emotionally, for those who work there, the trauma, obviously, the fear from the trauma they lived through, some of the survivors were gravely injured in this attack and are still working there. And they talk about every time they hear a new noise in the newsroom, they're afraid. You know, what is that? What is this? Is there someone at the door? And that really begs the question, how do you keep doing your job when you have to go through so much security that it's really impairing your life, your enjoyment of your own personal life and your work life?
If you're trying to invest in an editorial and you've also got a really high cost of security, I mean, how is that affecting the staff? And what do they say about that in this issue?
Well, what they're talking about in terms of cost is that, as you may know, in 2015, right after the attacks, Charlie Hebdo all of a sudden got a flurry of subscriptions, you know, in solidarity. I think at the end of the year, 2015, they had collected something like $70 million, which was huge for them. But then that revenue has fallen sharply since, it appears, according to some reports. So they're seeing that they're hemorrhaging money, and they don't know how long they're going to be able to do this, to be paying for their own security, at $1.5 million a year at least.
So as you read between the lines of this first issue of 2018, did you detect any, almost like a warning from the publishers that Charlie Hebdo won't be around for much longer?
You could certainly read it like this. It's hard to know, but certainly there's a warning in there that they're tired, they're worn out, they're afraid for their lives. Nothing has improved over the past 3 years. And it's just sending a fair warning out there to their readers.
Editorially, what are critics saying? Does Charlie Hebdo still skewer with the same wit, or did those events 3 years ago kind of cause them to recoil and to pull punches in a way that it's not really rebounded from?
Nope, no recoiling. I think they have continued just as before, and that's what's admirable about it. You know, in the face of horrible murders and death threats, they've continued to do what they've been known for. They still have their edge, that's for sure.
Even if they were to shut down, I mean, memory is long among some extremists. Have you heard anything that suggests that these cartoonists would still be the object in civilian life of some people's hate?
Oh, that you have to assume that the newspaper shutting down would be a victory for those who want to see all these cartoonists dead. So, but certainly they have made enemies for life. There is no question about it. And you can see that for some of those cartoonists, at least the most famous ones, they'll have to live with some kind of security for the rest of their lives.
Reporter Adeline Sear, thanks very much for your time.
You're welcome, Marco.
I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World, and apparently we just can't get enough mariachi. Last Friday, we brought you the story of Omar Nare. He's a California musician who's updating mariachi for a new generation and new ears. And today, we leave you with another group that's pushing the boundaries even more by mixing this traditional Mexican art form with, wait for it, heavy metal. We'll let two members of the LA-based group Metalachi tell their story.
Oh my God, you know, the way we feel when we perform, it's out of this world because, you know, if you go to a usual mariachi show, you know, it's a great performance and everyone's admiring the music and getting into the music and dancing. Multiply that by 1,000, you kind of get your experience at a Metalachi show because not only people are doing those things, but you're also including like some of the metal, heavy metal energy from the fans. That's how it goes. You've never seen a mosh pit to a mariachi until you go to a Metalachi show, you know, where people are just going crazy and it gets loud we drive from that energy, you know, and we just eat it up. There's some times where I don't even want to get off the stage because it just feels so good. This is El Cucuy from Metelachi. I play the trumpet. Buenos dias. Welcome to the show. And here to my side is the very handsome and daring Vega de la Roca.
Hola, mi nombre es Vega de la Roca, and I am the singer of Metalachi.
When there's lightning, you know it always brings me down. Cause it's free and I see that it's me who's lost and never found.
That is Rainbow in the Dark from Dio. Growing up in Los Angeles, there's a huge Mexican community here in Los Angeles. You're prone to listen to a lot of mariachi music.
No, we started playing music at a very young age. The family that we grew up with, they were all musicians. They're all mariachi musicians.
I have friends that listen to not only Mexican traditional music, but also metal music. Growing up, I would imitate those singers like Dio and AC/DC. I guess that's how I might have gotten the range that I have at this point.
Some of our relatives also, they played different types of music. What was top 40 back then in the 1980s?
Oh, you got Journey.
Rick James.
Rick James.
Some the Bee Gees.
Staying alive.
Doing alive.
Then we had Cheech and Chong.
Yeah. We used to play mariachi, you know, just regular mariachi at weddings, quinceañeras, shows, stuff like that. Well, there's always a couple of us that always like to push the envelope a little bit, try something new. We took it way out by actually playing some metal songs just for fun, you know. People really loved it. I still remember that quinceañera where we played that song for the first time. And
by the way, a quinceañera is like a sweet 16.
But it's 15.
But it's 15.
Just distinctly remember because, like, this grandma that was in a wheelchair, we started playing it and she put her horns up and just got out of her chair and just started dancing.
It was a miracle.
So you can walk again. Thanks to the first Metalachi song. You wouldn't think that metal music and mariachi would fuse together very well, but it's actually very surprising on how well they merge together. I mean, we got to admit there are some metal songs that we have tried to put into mariachi style that quite don't translate, you know. Metal music is very heavy on the drums for the drive and the electric guitars, and our band does not have drums. Our band does not have electric guitars, and so we try to find that drive using the mariachi instruments. Mariachi's songs of life, songs of love, a lot of them are real experiences. Well, same thing with metal. A lot of times people don't realize how beautiful the songs are because of all the screaming and noise. The lyrics are actually extremely beautiful.
When we perform on stage, I would say it's more like a party, you know, it's like a fiesta. We have our sombreros, we have costumes that resemble both genres, mariachi and metal at the same time. You know, we have studs.
I guess you can say that I was very much influenced by
Gene Simmons.
Gene Simmons from Kiss with the white makeup and black. I wear a lot of armor, some spikes.
When we played in Mexico, a lot of people, they didn't know what to expect. Going out there, I was nervous because we didn't know what to expect from the fans. And, you know, we played in Mexico City, and so we had a really good response.
Yeah, a lot of people think that you go to Mexico and that they're going to, like, crucify us because we're not, like, traditional mariachi. But, you know, a lot of the people in Mexico are actually, they've gone away from the tradition and they really opened up to something new.
There's a big metal community in Mexico, as well as, you know, of course, the original traditional Mexican music lovers out there. So it's a great combination then.
Metalachi has experienced some negative responses. There's been people that tell us, hey, this isn't metal, or this isn't an original idea. You know, we're not everybody's cup of tea.
But once they see it, a lot of people are like, oh, I didn't know what to expect, and I thought it was going to be, you know, a ridiculous idea. But once they see it and they're there, it changes their mind completely.
Some of the most traditional mariachi musicians around come to our shows, and they loved it. They love what we do. The same thing with metal. I mean, we have some old school heavy metal, like some big cats. You know, we're talking about
Dave Lombardo.
Dave Lombardo actually shared the stage with us, and he used to play with Slayer. We get support from everywhere. I think the support that we get, by far, it outweighs the negative. Metalachi, I mean, we're very close. It's like a family. I mean, we live together on the road, and we travel a lot. You can really see everybody really gel and bond. It's like this isn't something new that we're giving to the world, and we're very proud of it.
El Cucuy and Vega de la Rocha, not their real names, by the way. It's all part of the act. They're with the L.A.-based band Metalachi. They spoke with our colleagues at the BBC. From the Nana Bill Harris Studios here at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. We'll be back with you tomorrow. And rock on. We come from the land of the answers, not from the midnight sun with the hot streets blow.
PRI, Public Radio International.